The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So we are in our fourth week of our five-week series on the precepts, the guidelines for ethical conduct taught by the Buddha. And last week we talked about the third precept being the guidelines around sexual conduct, to refrain from sexual misconduct. And I wanted to check in with those of you who were here and to find out how it went this week, looking at that. It seemed to generate a lot of discussion and interest last week in terms of it being a juicy precept to look at. So I'm just curious how it went, if anybody is willing or interested in sharing some of their observations.
Maybe I'm cheating because I really didn't get to the sexual part, but what I really heard and really loved was this idea of not hurting ourselves or others. And I've been sort of listening to what the Buddha told his son all week and just loving it. It's like so simple and so big all at the same time. So I really appreciate hearing that.
That's great. That is a huge piece of what I wanted to emphasize, which is that the teachings on ethical conduct are really about non-harming, not harming ourselves and not harming others. And as you mentioned, I talked about what the Buddha taught to his seven-year-old son about reflecting on our conduct before, during, and after our actions, to look, to observe, is this harming others or is it a skillful action? And it is a challenging one, but it is a beautiful teaching, so I'm glad you found that helpful.
So I was going to say something about what you were talking about in terms of sexual energy. Just probably a few weeks ago, I think I just stopped wearing all makeup. And it's really interesting how, when I do wear it going out, you know, to certain functions, I feel almost like a fake. It's really interesting how for a long time I've wanted to move away from that, and I thought, you know, I've broken so many barriers in so many ways and come to the truth on so many terms, but that is one thing where I still feel like I have to look a certain way in order to be someone. And so, I mean, it went along the lines of someone last week who was saying she had to dress a certain way at work. So I thought that was really powerful for me. And I felt like, I mean, it's just more of an honest, maybe, you know, maybe it's related to sexual energy or not, but it's just so much more honest when that piece isn't there. And, you know, I got tempted to throw everything of mine out. I wasn't brave enough to do that, but I'm sure that'll happen one day.
That's a beautiful story. Thank you for sharing that. Did anybody experiment with the reflective practice that I taught at all during the week?
No.
Yeah.
I heard of that as a form of analytical meditation, and had done it in the past in reference to a few paragraphs of the Heart Sutra or the Diamond Sutra, you know, just to kind of open a different perspective. Just reading, you know, the Heart Sutra, the Diamond Sutra, ordinarily I just, oh, this is kind of, you know, what? You know, there's no, it just goes.
Right.
through it, and then meditating first, and then having that meditative kind of openness that arises, and then a few paragraphs, you know, just a paragraph or two. And well, the experiences arise. But I think I would prefer on a retreat, you know, to take that into a retreat rather than, you know, when I come home from work.
Mm-hmm. The reason I taught it as a daily life practice is that it's a way to allow for a contemplation that's not so thoughtful or analytical or thinking oriented. It's more of an experiential reflection, and to apply it to just about anything. We can apply it to questions we have about how we want to make choices in our life, to bring a more reflective quality to looking at how we want to move through our lives, even. And on retreat, actually on the retreats that I have been on and on the retreats that I teach, we tend to actually discourage that kind of reflection. To just come into the experience completely. So it's interesting that you find it more drawing for you in a retreat. And you know, just see if you can play with maybe a different way of looking at that as a practice to support looking at your life in a different way.
Well, if there's so much I don't want to know, and I know that I don't want to know, and it's kind of like a prejudice, kind of like a refusal,
mm-hmm.
And then in meditation I forget that I don't want to know. And lo and behold, here's some information I didn't want.
Yes, we run into that when we meditate, absolutely. You're right. Yeah, and you know, you're right that in our daily lives it can be a little more challenging to deal with the upheaval of learning that information. On retreat we have a little more spaciousness around it. So, but I just encourage you to keep playing with it. Keep trying. Keep looking at your experience from this kind of more reflective way. So I'd like to go on to our precept of the evening, which is refraining from false speech. So I'll read you what the suttas say about this. There is a case where a certain person, abandoning false speech, abstains from false speech. When he has been called to a town meeting, a group meeting, a gathering of his relatives, his guild, or of the royalty, if he is asked as a witness, come and tell, good man, what do you know? If he doesn't know, he says, I don't know. If he does know, he says, I know. If he hasn't seen, he says, I haven't seen. If he has seen, he says, I have seen. Thus, he doesn't consciously tell a lie for his own sake, for the sake of another, or for the sake of any reward. Abandoning false speech, he abstains from false speech. He speaks the truth, holds to the truth, is firm, reliable, no deceiver of the world. So this is a relatively simple precept in some ways, although it's got so many subtleties and different gradations to it. So again, you know, it really has to do with the intention behind it. The intention to, I've talked a lot about intention during these weeks, But the intention to speak falsely has to come into play in order for the precept to be broken. So that means that if you speak something and don't know that it's not the truth, that's not breaking the precept. The intention to lie has to come into play. Although an interesting piece that they talk about is that so the intention to deceive has to come into play, but actual deception does not have to happen in order for the precept to be broken. So that is, you may speak with the intention to deceive someone, but they might know the truth and know that you're deceiving them. I thought that was a kind of an interesting point. And in that case, you're still not absolved from breaking the precept. It is, you had the intention to deceive. That it is, it's really the intention that is the key piece that we look at all the time in our conduct, looking at what is our intention. The instructions to his son. I didn't read this part of the sutta last week, but in the instructions to his son, Rahula, the Buddha started the discussion about non-harming by talking about refraining from lying. And in fact, you kind of get the sense at the beginning of the sutta that Rahula has told a lie that day and that his father is telling him the consequences of this. And in fact, he gives some interesting analogies. Little analogies. He says, there was a little water in a water vessel, and he asked his son, "Do you see this little water left in this water vessel?" Even so, Rahula, is the recluseness of those who are not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie. And then he throws the water away and says, "Do you see that water that was thrown away?" And he says, "Even those who are not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie have thrown away their goodness." And he goes over on and he turns the vessel upside down and says, "You see how that's turned upside down?" And he says, "So too, a person who tells a deliberate lie has turned upside down their goodness." So he's really emphasizing in ways that a seven-year-old can understand the consequences of telling a lie. And at the end of this discussion, he says, "Rahula, when one is not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie, there is no evil that one would not do. Therefore, Rahula, you should train thus. I will not utter a falsehood, even as a joke." So he's telling his seven-year-old son this, not to lie even as a joke. I think that's a pretty strong statement. Because often I think, and this I feel is one of the subtleties that comes into play, we often shade the truth or lie in the form of a joke, in the form of humor. That sometimes we look at telling humorous things, and a little twist to the truth makes it funnier. So we do that. And the Buddha is saying to us, not even that kind of lie is acceptable. To really look at, again, look at the motivation. What is the point of that? That twist of truth. Sometimes when we, and again, another area that might be a little bit gray or shady for some of us is the area of a white lie, or a lie meant to conceal something that we feel might harm somebody else if we were to tell them the truth. And again, the intention there is perhaps a protective one, to protect them from harm. But on the other hand, perhaps there's another way to protect them from harm rather than engaging in that deliberate lie ourselves. So to look at how we could speak truthfully and yet still refrain from harming. There's other areas. Exaggeration is an area that sometimes we engage in. And thinking back too about the humor, you know, just as a kind of a contrast. I mean, we often think of when we tell humorous things of adding a little twist that maybe is just a little bit of a falsehood. But you know, I found that as I've observed my own mind, the truth of the mind is actually pretty amusing. You know, when we actually look at the way our minds function, it's laughable. It's pretty funny the way our minds work. The way the mind will try to twist things and puff ourselves up and make ourselves look good. It's quite amusing. And, you know, it's something that as you get a little bit less attached to an idea of who you are, we can be a little more playful with how the mind works. So truth itself can actually be humorous. And one of the things I remember of Gill saying a lot in years past is, it's good to be able to laugh at yourself because then you'll be endlessly amused. So looking at the truth, and the truth can be humorous. So we don't actually have to twist the truth we don't have to abandon humor in order to tell the truth. Then there's, exaggeration or perhaps shading a story to make it more interesting. And I have a story about this. At one point, one friend of mine told me that when I was telling stories about other people, that I shouldn't put it in the third person. Oh, I know a friend who did this or this or this. This was before I was in the practice, and it wasn't anybody involved in the practice. But he said, it makes the story more interesting if you tell it in the first person. And I was off in the Peace Corps at one point, and a friend of mine there had a very funny story about a spider it was funny to me at the time. It's not as funny to me now, but... They had these spiders there that were quite large, and they had an egg, the female spiders would have an egg sac under them, and when they needed to break their egg sac, they would jump to break the egg sac, and there'd be these leaping spiders. And one of my friends was just terrified of spiders, and she took this broom and whacked the spider. And she said it was like a cartoon because it turned into this incredible mass of baby spiders that then appeared because her blow of the broom broke the egg sac for the mother. And so I related this story in a letter to my mother and told it in the first person. And my mother thought this story was worth retelling. And for years, she retold the story. And then I got involved in the practice. And I got very uncomfortable as she told the story. And I, for a while, wasn't sure how to deal with this. And I was just silent. And then when I was in the room, she would say, Oh, my daughter has a very funny story about a spider. Why don't you tell your story? And I would just decline to tell the story. And then one day she brought it up with a group of my friends who were also practitioners. And I couldn't stand it anymore. And I said, you know, Mom, that wasn't my story. I have to come clear here. You know, it was another person's story. And I told it in the first person because somebody told me once it would make it more interesting to tell it in the first person. And my mom was appalled. She said, you mean all those people I lied to? And a friend of mine said, no, you didn't lie. So, that kind of shading, you know, as we get more sensitive to our conduct, these kinds of things will become sensitive to them. So, you know, there's just so many different shades to this precept. But this precept also, I mean, beyond the precept, you know, this topic of speech in our daily lives is huge. And it's a place where we end up harming so easily and so quickly without really being aware of what's going on. So I want to expand the topic a little bit tonight beyond just the strict refraining from false speech, to talk a little more generally about the topic of speech and how to engage in non-harmful speech. So there's a teaching on wise speech in the texts, and this talks about four different areas or four different ways of speaking that are supportive of wise speech. And these are, the first one is refraining from lying. So that's the first one, always. Speech should be truthful. And then he talks about refraining from harsh speech, refraining from divisive speech, and refraining from idle chatter. So the harsh speech one is about speaking harsh words, disagreeable words. Abusive speech is sometimes called, refraining from abusive speech. Divisive speech is that kind of speech that intends to divide people from each other. So saying things that are intended to set us apart from other people. The words say, what he has heard here, he does not tell there to break those people apart from these people here. That's what's meant by divisive speech. I've often heard this related in terms of gossip, that this is one of the things the Buddha says not to do. Do not gossip. But actually, I mean, where people think of gossip as meaning speaking about somebody who's not here. But if you're speaking about someone who's not here and the intention is not to divide yourself from that person, that is not considered wrong speech or unwise speech. So I just want to bring that up because I think there's sometimes a misunderstanding that people have about what the Buddha taught in this area. He doesn't say not to speak about somebody who's not here. He does say not to speak about people in a divisive way. The last one, idle chatter, it may be one of the more challenging ones for us. Because so much of our speech might fall into this category. You know, we speak about movies we've seen or books we've read. And in the Buddha's definition, idle chatter is pretty much anything that's not related to the Dhamma. So, again, I think in our lay lives, we need to think about the intention. Are we intending to promote concord and harmony with our speech? And sometimes I find that what feels like or on the surface seems to be idle chatter is actually something that serves to connect two people that are kind of trying to find a common ground. So it's underneath, it's not idle chatter. So again, we really need to look at the intention. What is the purpose behind this speech? In addition to these ways of looking at speech itself, the looking at how we are speaking, there are also some other things that he suggests that we pay attention to. They are whether or not what we are saying is beneficial to the person we're speaking to. And whether or not it's the proper time to speak about it. So the beneficial aspect has to do with whether or not the information or what's being said is supportive of concord, supportive of harmony. And now here again, he doesn't say that we shouldn't speak if what we're going to say is not agreeable to others. So it may be beneficial, but something they don't want to hear. But here he's pretty clear. He has two things I want to read. In the case of the words one knows to be factual, true, beneficial, but unendearing and disagreeable to others, have a sense of the proper time for saying them. And then again, if you're going to say words that you know to be factual, true, beneficial, and endearing and agreeable, you have a sense of the proper time for saying them. So both sides. You've got a proper time for saying beneficial things that somebody wants to hear and some beneficial things that somebody doesn't want to hear. You've got a sense of the proper time for saying them. And by that proper time, I take to mean whether somebody is in the right frame of mind to hear something, whether the people who are in the gathering are appropriate to hear this thing also. So really looking at the context. What's the context in which we're speaking? And is this an appropriate time to speak? So there's a lot to look at in our speech, a lot to think about as we communicate with other people. This practice involves mindfulness, being aware of our speech, knowing that we are going to speak. So many times we speak without knowing that we're going to speak. We speak without really even knowing what we're going to say before we say it. And much less do we even think about how what we're going to say is going to impact somebody else. So what is the impact on that person? So a really good thing to play with, and I encourage you to play with this in your week, is to pause before you speak. If you can manage to do that, if you can manage to pause before you speak, first of all, you will have caught that intention to speak. There is an intention before we speak. There's an intention actually before every act of body or speech or mind. And if you can pause before you speak, you have caught that intention to speak. You've made it, you've noticed that you're going to speak and you've made a moment of pause. So that, in that pause, in that moment of pausing before you speak, you are probably going to know what you were planning to say before you said it. And in that moment, first of all, you can check whether it was truthful, whether it is a truthful thing to say. You also might have a sense of what your motivation is. What's your underlying reason for saying this thing? And again, in that case, we can begin to look at, is the motivation one of these other ways in which the Buddha encourages us not to speak? Is it divisive? Is it harsh? Is there a harshness to it? Is there an idle quality to it, just, oh, wanting to say something because there's silence and feeling uncomfortable with the silence? So there, we would have the opportunity in that pause to reflect not only on what we're going to say, but why we're going to say it. And that's very powerful, to have that pause. Now it's hard. It's hard to pause. I have to tell you, this is not an easy practice. And you'll likely forget for most of the week. Actually, I'd encourage you to pick a time to find somebody to practice this with. You know, to sit down and see if you can find somebody who would play with this with you over a lunch or something. To see if you can agree to communicate in this way for a period of, say, 20 minutes or so, and see what happens to you. One of the times I tried this with another friend, a practitioner, I remember we were sitting having lunch, and I sat there and I thought of something I wanted to say, and I realized, oh, probably not a good thing to say. So I didn't say it. And then something else came up and I thought, no, I don't think so. I don't think I'll say that. And I sat there for a while, several minutes, I think, in silence, ruling out things to say. And finally, I had to say to him that I was sitting here ruling out things to say because I could see that they were not quite skillful. So you might be surprised what happens to you. I was quite shocked, actually, that so many of the things that just naturally came to my mind had just a little bit of a twist. It wasn't that they were false, but there was just a little bit of a twist of self-aggrandizement or you know, joining us two together against somebody else, or you just very subtle little movements of mind that weren't so skillful. So play with this and see what happens to you. It's if you're doing it with somebody who knows what you're doing, it can feel a little less awkward than if you're doing it just like at work or something. You know, people at work don't often actually wait for a pause, I find. You know, they'll just jump right in and start speaking. So maybe a hard place to do it at work. Another place to look, I found the practice of mindful speech to be one of the most difficult places to bring mindfulness to in my practice. And at one retreat I was on, it was a retreat in Burma, where the teacher was encouraging us to behave a little more normally than we usually do on retreat. It was with Saida Utejaniya, who came here this last summer. Some of you may have participated in the session with him. And he likes to encourage more of a daily lifestyle in the monastery. So we're allowed to speak on retreat, and this was unusual for me to be on a retreat where we were allowed to speak. And in fact, we talked about it in interviews. He encouraged us at times to look at how we were reacting when somebody came to speak with us. So at one point, a man came and wanted to speak with me for a while, and we were walking together and talking. And after a while, I felt kind of tired of talking with him, and yet he kept going on, and I said something that I felt like would close the subject, and yet he just picked it up and started on another topic. And I didn't quite know how to just say, okay, I've had enough. I'm ready to stop. I mean, I could have said that, but I didn't say that. And the next day, my mind was quite agitated. It was not as calm in the meditation. So it was like that conversation I felt like had really disrupted the calm of my meditation. So I reported this to the teacher. And he laughed at me. He said, oh, you got agitated while you were talking. Keep that in mind. Just notice whether you're getting agitated or whether you're staying calm. And so for a while, that became my main kind of filter in looking at my speech. Just, am I agitated or am I calm? And if I noticed I was starting to get agitated, I would stop. I would slow down a little bit and bring my mind back into calm. And in that working in that way, I found that it was much easier to stay connected to the mindful speeching and to not allow the mind to get so agitated. So this is another place to play. You know, to look at, see if you can just simply notice, are you getting agitated while you're speaking? Or are you calm? So just that very simple balance. So working with this precept, working with the precept of refraining from false speech, the flip side of it is that it cultivates truthfulness. It cultivates honesty. So this is a really beautiful quality to cultivate. And it's a very deep quality, actually. It goes to the heart of the whole practice, that in our in our minds and our experience, what we are looking towards is a truthfulness of mind, a clarity of mind, delusion is essentially the quality that we are trying to uncover in our minds. Expose the delusion. And often it seems like when we run up against delusion in our minds, we want to, like, oh no, that doesn't exist. I'm not really that deluded. So we don't really want to be truthful about our own, how we function in our minds. So this cultivating this precept of truthfulness in our speech begins to head us in this direction of being able to be more honest with ourselves about what we're actually experiencing. So being willing to acknowledge when we've done something maybe not so skillful. I find in my own mind a tendency at times to try to reframe the situation if I feel like I've done something wrong. Oh, well, maybe it wasn't so bad if I look at it this way. And, you know, I can just see it's the mind trying to manipulate the experience. So really coming into a real honest assessment of our actions. This precept helps us move in that direction. So I want to just check in and see if there's any questions or comments about what I've said so far.
Question about divisive speech.
Divisive speech.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder where political speech comes into that.
Well, it sure seems like there's a lot of divisive speech going on in the political arena these days. I have to say, it's very uncomfortable to watch. Yeah, I mean, it's. I don't think that, you know, it's not what the Buddha would call wise speech, much of what's going on in the political arena. Was there a particular question you had about it?
Part of my job is writing political speech, and so...
Writing political speech?
Mm-hmm. For nonprofits and so on, so I'm trying to come to terms with what you just said.
Yeah, if you can... You know, looking at that, that's a challenging place. If your job is requiring you to do things that are a little bit twisted like that, you know, to really look at, you know, that it is a twist. I mean, it's a twist of intention, essentially. Yeah, you know, that to look at, is it possible in the work that you do, are you being requested to write this kind of speech, or is it possible for you to write more along the lines of promoting your candidate, promoting a particular point of view, as opposed to saying somebody else's is? I mean, you can honestly say what you feel is wrong or unskillful about somebody else's point of view without being divisive. You know, so there's a way. I mean, it's not that we can't say we disagree with people, but to do it in a way that's not saying they're wrong, they're bad, they're stupid, they're ignorant. So, you know, to really look at how you can you frame it in a way that is not divisive. It could be a challenge. And it seems to me, I mean, looking at the candidates, you know, it seems to me that they're actively being divisive. You know, that is part of their intention, is to be divisive. And, you know, it's not seeming like it's so helpful, at least to me. I've kind of tuned it out.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
this topic, and I'm sure this question is belongs here, but part of it is around if you could elaborate on intention. And as I'm hearing you say it here, it's the intention with that specific act of speech.
Mm-hmm.
And it's connected to the other part of what I was going to say was I've been on the receiving end of lies from someone who walks this path, this practice. And it's been very confusing to me how to heal from that.
Yeah.
So I don't know how that fits in here, but I would always get hung up on this intention word, because what I would get back would be something along the lines, well, it's of my intention to speak truthfully, but you're not, you know. And it's, so the intention being broken down more to the specific, and I'm even questioning myself about asking this question. Is this divisive of me to ask this question? But I'm actually really trying to understand it so I can figure out how to move forward with my own healing.
Yeah. So intention is a huge topic. And so I'll just talk a little bit about it and see if this gets to what you're thinking about. The intention, the way I've been using intention is really, it's more along the lines of looking at motivation. You know, when I said a few minutes ago there's an intention behind every action of body, speech, or mind, that's true, that there is a kind of an impulse behind it. We can know we're going to move before we move. We can know we're going to speak before we speak. We can even know we're going to think before we think. That sounds a little unusual, but that is possible. But always accompanying that moment of intending is the motivation or the reason why we're going to do something. So in every single moment, there's a motivation for what is about to happen. And that's the place where that's actually the key, the crux of where the Buddha talked about where our freedom comes from, is being able to see that moment of intention and how we're going to act, how we're going to move in the world. That we have a choice in this moment, and our choice of whether we choose to act towards things that take us away from suffering, skillful actions, or things that lead us into suffering, that's all that we can do in a moment, is choose right here and now, am I going to act skillfully or not skillfully? And sometimes, often what happens is if we're not aware of this moment when we're making this choice, our habits choose for us how we're going to act. Our habits often choose unskillfully, actually. Sometimes they choose skillfully, but often our habits are motivated by greed and self-interest and aversion. So bringing awareness to this moment, to what is happening in this moment and what our choices are and what the motivation for those choices are, is the crux. It is the point that the Buddha really points us to in this whole path. The whole path unfolds from this very moment, and what our intention is, how we step into the next moment. So it absolutely is the intention of this moment that is the most important. You can set your intention, and I hope to talk about that just a little bit in a few minutes, that you can set your intention towards speaking truthfully. That in fact, one of the ways to think about these precepts is to think about engaging with them on a daily basis. To say my intention is to engage in truthful speech. My intention is to refrain from false speech. To refrain from sexual misconduct. To refrain from killing living beings. Refrain from taking what's not given. So to state that to yourself on a daily basis, and that is a way of setting your intention in a moment. And then when we stray from that during the day, we have to very truthfully acknowledge when we have strayed and make reparations. Forgiveness practice is another thing, and that sounds like what you may need to work with, is some forgiveness practice, forgiving your the person But also knowing that forgiveness doesn't mean necessarily that it was okay that they behaved in that way. And I'm going to talk about forgiveness practice a lot next week, so I hope you can make it next week. I don't know if that addressed any of your... So I wanted to just move on now. Last week I said that I would we could do the precepts in Pali this week. So I brought handouts that show the precepts in Pali, and I will teach you the chant for these. I think I have enough for everybody. So I'll just talk a little bit about this while it's going around. So taking the precepts, talking about them is one thing, but engaging with them on a regular basis is another. And some of you may wish to try this, to try working with these precepts on more of a regular basis. And taking the precepts on a daily basis is one way to engage with them. It's a way that we can remind ourselves of what our intention is. So it's a way to kind of set our direction. This is the way I'd like to be in the world. And actually, as we do this, as we set this intention, it's a purifying piece in and of itself to just engage in this moment, intending to engage in working with these precepts in a skillful way. So if you look at these, there's five of them listed here, and they're all the same except for the first word of each one. So the first one, panatipata, and then the rest of it is varatmani sikapadang samadhiyami. Panatipata means, I'll tell you what the second part of it means first. So varatmani sikapadang samadhiyami. Varatmani means abstain. Sikapadang means training rule. And samadhiyami essentially means an undertaking. So this means I'm undertaking this training rule to abstain from. And then the beginning piece, panatipata, yeah.
Could you say again what the sikapadam means?
Sikapadam means training rule.
Training rule?
That essentially means precept. So it means training rule. So in each of these five, panatipata means breathing being. Adinadana means taking what is not given. Kamesu michachara means wrong conduct of sense pleasure, but the conduct, the commentaries actually say it refers explicitly in this case to sexual relationship. So wrong conduct in sexual relationship. Musawada means to lie. And then this last one is a little more complicated. Sura mereya maja pamadatana means distilled, fermented liquor and intoxicants that promote heedlessness. Well, if any kind of alcohol is considered distilled, or I think beer is distilled, but anyway, I don't know. Anyway, it also says intoxicants. So any intoxicant, so that includes the more recently created intoxicants. So this is typically done in a chanting style. So the way we'll do it tonight is we'll do it in a call and response form. So I will chant a word, and then you can chant it back. I also want, there's another thing I want to say, that typically these five precepts are taken along with the three refuges. And Gil is going to be giving a class on the three refuges, I think starting next month. Do you know if that's true, Maureen? So it's starting next month. So if you're interested in exploring the refuges, you might want to attend his class. But for this class, since we've just been talking about the precepts, I'm just going to do the chanting of the precepts. So the tune is pretty simple. It's not a difficult tune. So I'll chant a word and then you can chant it back. Panatipata.
Panatipata.
Veratmani.
Veratmani.
Sikapadang.
Sikapadang.
Samadhiyami.
Samadhiyami.
Adinadana.
Adinadana.
Veratmani.
Sikapadang.
Sikapadang. Samadhiyami.
Samadhiyami.
Kamesu.
Kamesu.
Michachara.
Michachara.
Veratmani.
Veratmani.
Sikapadang.
Sikapadang.
Samadhiyami.
Samadhiyami.
Musawada. Veratmani.
Veratmani.
Sikapadang.
Sikapadang.
Samadhiyami.
Samadhiyami.
Sura.
Sura.
Mereya.
Mereya.
Maja.
Maja.
Pamada.
Pamada.
Tana.
Tana.
Veratmani.
Veratmani.
Sikapadang.
Sikapadang.
Samadhiyami.
Samadhiyami.
Now in a minute I think we'll do it again. And the way we'll do it this next time is that I'll chant a line and then I'll chant the line again with you. So that we'll do a whole line. And then after that, and what I encourage you to do if you take the precepts on your own, to do them in English as well. Because there can be a way in which we just go through the motions of saying these Pali words without really reflecting on what the meaning is. And I find it helpful. I find it helpful when I do the precepts to do both the Pali and the English. But if you just want to do one, I would do the English. So we'll do a chanting of the Pali. I'll chant a line, then you can chant it. And then we'll speak. We won't chant the English. Panatipata veratmani sikapadang samadhiyami. Panatipata veratmani sikapadang samadhiyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from killing living beings. Adinadana veratmani sikapadang samadhiyami. Adinadana veratmani sikapadang samadhiyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from taking that which is not given. Kamesu michachara veratmani sikapadang samadhiyami. Kamesu michachara veratmani sikapadang samadhiyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from sexual misconduct. Musawada veratmani sikapadang samadhiyami. Musawada veratmani sikapadang samadhiyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from false speech. Sura mereya maja pamada tana veratmani sikapadang samadhiyami. Sura mereya maja pamada tana
Veratmani Sikapadang Samadhiyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from intoxicants which lead to carelessness. So, if you are interested in engaging with these precepts more regularly, it can be helpful to actually call them to mind on a regular basis. So you can take this home with you if you wish. If you do not wish to take it home with you or feel like you just throw it away when you got home, please leave the sheet on the table by the Dhana boxes. So it's time to end, and next week we'll speak about the precept on intoxicants, as well as the issue of forgiveness and working with what happens as we inevitably do break the precepts. So thank you for your attention.